Thanks for listening to The Treatment. So I bet you're curious about what gadget you'll be using next, or maybe you're like me, you just want to visit the most cutting-edge museums. So KCRW is a podcast, DNA, that sheds light on the culture and trends in design and architecture, hosted by an industry insider. Check it out. I think you'll dig it. Find DNA on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I've been doing this show for about 17 years now, and I so often get asked, how did you get started? What made you want to do this? The man sitting across from me, Lawrence Grobel, who's, I'll put it this way, I'm such a cliche, I used to read Playboy magazine for the articles, and among the articles I read in Playboy, his interviews with Barbara Streisand, his interview with Marlon Brando, which is 35 years old this year, which made me think about your book, Conversations with Brando. His newest book is I Want You in My Movie, a look at the making of Al Pacino's Salome film, in which he's intimately involved, Larry Grobel, Lawrence Grobel. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you here.
Hey, it's an honor to be
here. You're the reason I'm here. So this is the reason I wanted to have you here. As an interviewer, and your work to me is so profound, and some of the things that you touch on end up being a part of this time you spend with Pacino, and I Want You in My Movie. So first of all, let the audience know what that book's about.
Well, what happened is Al was going to make, decided he wanted to make a documentary and a movie of Salome. He was obsessed with Oscar Wilde. He loved the words and the language. And he knew it was going to be a small movie. It was going to be one of those movies like Looking for Richard or Chinese Coffee or the local stigmatic things that he does.
These artistic obsessions.
His artistic obsessions. And I think what he may be remembered for, along with The Godfather and Scarface in the first five films. I think some of these films are really extraordinary. I always loved the local stigmatic. I think Looking for Richard, the New York Times put it as a top 10 film of the year. And yet nobody really knows about a lot of these films that he did. And this was going to be another one, Oscar Wilde, his obsession there. So the day before he was going to make the start shooting, he was going to direct the movie, and Stell Parsons was going to direct the play that was going to be at the Wadsworth Theater. The day before, he says to me, and I've known him now since 1978. We've become very close friends, and I'd see him all the time. And we talked about this project a lot. So he says, I want you in my movie. He says, you can wear a hat or get an identity, do whatever you want. He says, but I want you to be like the obnoxious reporter. I said, what do you want me to do? He says, well, I want you to come and interrupt me when I'm talking to people. Just come and interrupt. I said, are you going to tell anybody about that? He says, no. I just let's see how this goes. Now, I thought, I better go over to Estelle Parsons because she is directing this thing. And when she and he are in conference and talking, I'm supposed to go over there and interrupt them and say something to him. So I came and I asked if she knew who I was. And she said, you're an actor, right? I said, no, I'm not. I'm actually Al's friend. I'm a writer. And he's asked me to interrupt you when you're talking. So, and that's how it got started. But what I said to Al was, if I'm going to really do this, then I might as well write a book about it because I'm spending an awful lot of time doing this. As it turned out, it's been 8 years that this project started. It started in 2006.
We should say it was the film debut of Jessica Chastain.
And Jessica Chastain's film debut, and she's terrific in it. I don't know if you have seen it.
I have seen it, yeah.
Because I saw it about 45 times, and every time was different because I watched the 3.5-hour version.
You mentioned in the book that each iteration is different. Right. And his – interesting about this book, and I thought about the Brando interview, which is now in the selection, Conversations with Brando, but you also have Conversations with Capote and Conversations with Michener and your great book of interviews, Icons, which comes from the Polish magazine Trendy. But one of the things I thought about in reading that book, because I went and dug up my copy of Brando, which I couldn't find, but I can remember it anyway, is just, first of all, you have these two guys who were so much more than we ever saw of them on screen and who were trying to figure out what art meant to them. And you have these arguments with Brando. Right. About art and him refusing to take acting seriously and saying that film would never be considered art. I remember that vividly. And for Pacino, for him, art is this inchoate thing that's constantly changing. And the things that sort of unite I Want You in My Movie and the Brando conversation and many of the things you've done, in fact, even with Streisand, is the anger that comes up in these people when they're forced to try to figure out what art means to them. I mean, it's just watching them try to say it.
It's very, very, very accurate, very good, Elvis. And it's true because See, there are people like Streisand and Brando. Those are the two of the people that I've been with. And I've been with hundreds and hundreds of famous people. So, and in all walks of life, Nobel Prize winners, writers like Saul Bellow, Norman Mailer, that kind of thing. You know, but when I remember talking to Brando on his island about acting, and he didn't want to talk about it, and he said everybody's an actor, and, you know, and we act all the time.
He talks about Dale Carnegie in the interview, betraying people to be actors.
but the point with him was he had a real natural talent. He didn't have to work for it. And when Stella Adler talked about, you know, he says, oh, Stella Adler taught me things. She said, no, this guy came in and he kicked down the door. I mean, I didn't have to teach him anything.
She showed him, she said in the interview, she showed him where the door was, and he kicked it down.
Yeah, he kicked it down. And in the sense with Pacino, I mean, with Streisand, let's go back to what I'm trying to say with the two of them. With Streisand, I asked her once, do you want to be remembered as an actor or be remembered as a singer? Without a hesitation, she said, actor. I said, but you know you're going to be remembered as a singer. And she says, I never had to work for that. I've had to work to be an actor, but singing just came naturally. I opened my mouth and that was it. So she took that for granted. Brando took acting for granted. And so he always put himself down about it. You know, it's kind of like not the right thing for a guy to be doing or something. Pacino, on the other hand, admired Brando. That's how I got to know Al, because he kept reading over and over the Playboy interview I did with Brando. And so when Pacino finally agreed to do an interview for Playboy, he said, I'll only do it with the guy who did Brando. I didn't know that. I got the call to do this interview from the editor of Playboy, and he says, guess what? We got Al Pacino. I said, terrific. He says, but you got to be there Wednesday. This was Monday. And I said, I can't do that, because I was interviewing Steve Martin at the time, and I said, I can't. I said, I don't have time to prepare. And then the editor said, you don't understand. He said he'll only do it with the guy who did Brando. That's who I became, Elvis, for about a couple of years after that. Everybody wanted to talk to me because I talked to Brando.
Let's remind people that what it was like to get to Marlon Brando. By that point, in that decade, he'd sat down with Dick Cavett, and that was it.
He hadn't
done anything else.
In 23 years. His last interview was with Truman Capote
in The New Yorker.
Right, and that was in 1956, I think, or something like that. He was making Sayonara. And I got to interview Brando all those years later, and I got to interview Capote all those years, you know, and I was able to talk to them about each other. So it was great. It was really terrific to be able to do that. But the Brando interview, to get to Brando or to get to Streisand was almost impossible. It took me 17 months to get to see Brando, and it took me almost the same amount of time just getting to see Barbara. And it was only when they'd made the decision, okay, you know, I'm ready to do this, is when, you know, you get to do that. So I think that's the reason Playboy chose me to do those early interviews too, because they figured I wasn't going to get paid until I finished it, and it could take me 16 months or something. What professional writer's got is going to do that? You have to be out of your mind. When you're young and you're energetic and you say, you know, you just go for it, and you go for it, you know, and you hope that it happens. And amazing, it happened. And those two interviews changed my life, because when Pacino said I wanted to be with the guy who did Brando, that was the way it was with Lily Tomlin, and that was the way it was with Streisand. I'd meet her later, you know.
And Lily Tomlin, by the way, about whom Brando did not say nice things.
Right, exactly. That's what always amazed me. You know, it was always awkward, because if Brando, you know, what he said about Bob Hope, you know, he would perform in a phone booth with one person down below his knees. Yeah, Brando could really be sharp, and he has a terrific mind. Brando is really smart. I've talked to De Niro. I've talked to Brando. I've talked to Pacino, you know. I've talked to a lot of actors.
But his assistant in the book, I'm going to recommend this book, Conversation with Brando, talks about his memory, that he could recall just about everything, and not just what you said, but what you were wearing and the way you put your hand to your face.
Well, see, I said to Brando, when you were doing Last Tango, you had, you know, stuff printed on Maria Schneider's ass. You know, I mean, basically, you know, he had cue cards all over the place. I said, why do you need that? It's surprising to me to hear that. He says, it doesn't matter. Why do I have to learn the lines, you know? And we're talking about it in my living room. And all of a sudden, as we're talking, and he's looking right at me, like you and I are looking at each other, he starts reciting the names of book titles. And, you know, he says about 20 book titles. I said, what are you doing? He says, I just read the top shelf of your bookshelf. Did you see my eyes go there? Amazing, right? He was looking at me. He was showing me how he did it.
It's the treat I'm thrilled to have as my guest today, Lawrence Grobel. Larry Grobel, his new book is I Want You in My Movie, the story of the making of the Salome film directed by Al Pacino, who also stars in it, and done a number of terrific interview is, again, the reason I am here, I can't say this enough, is I followed his example, the terrific stuff he did in Playboy magazine and many other places. But I want to get back to what I was saying about that anger. I mean, it comes to Streisand, too. I mean, this, and I wonder what it's like to be in those rooms with this kind of this misplaced rage, because I can't really articulate what it is that either attracts him to that thing or separates. When you were with Pacino in the UK and he's in Dublin, he's doesn't know what to make of what this thing is around him, and there's this frustration and this anger.
Well, I won't call it anger so much. I say that what happens is, you know, especially like in Pacino's thing, there's a tremendous artistic frustration going on. In this case, he's trying to figure out what he's doing in this movie, because basically everything he's doing is part of this movie. Every day it was something different. And then it was people coming to see screenings of it and they just didn't get it. And he was so frustrated by this because he was trying very hard. And what is he trying to do? He's trying to do a movie of a play. He's trying to do a documentary of the movie, of the play, of the actors. And he's trying to tell you Oscar Wilde stories. He's got three things going. So that was what was going on with him all the time. And it was interesting because you have to know Pacino to know that who he is who he's about to be playing or has just played. And so he can be very devilish and very angry when he did that movie about The Devil's Advocate. I have to remember that because otherwise it's like, oh my God, how can you be around this guy? But then you realize that that's who he is. So he brings his art into what he's doing and he's very intense in that way. And, you know, again, somewhat insecure intellectually because he never went to college, you know. I never found that with Brando. I don't think he was ever felt insecure around me. I would imagine when he was around the Supreme Court justices and things like that, he might have been like that. But otherwise, Brando was pretty solid on that. And Streisand is very knowledgeable, very smart woman.
But there's some of these people you talk to who are people who aren't conventionally educated, who have an enormous amount of savvy, who are very shrewd and often very articulate. But again, that anger comes up. It happens in so many of these things. It certainly happens with Capote. And I just find it kind of fascinating.
Well, you see, here's the thing. You're reading it as anger, and I'm reading it not as so much anger as a sense of where they're at.
Okay.
You know, I don't see it, you know, because I don't see too much anger in the interviews I've done with people. De Niro was the closest maybe to anger. Mitchum was a whole different story because I walked out on him and it would never happen. But with De Niro, you know, every time, you know, I get into anything having to do with anything of interest other than some certain movies. But you ask him about his childhood and he's doesn't want to talk about it. You ask him about his mother or father, he doesn't want to talk about it. So, you know, it's a very hard thing to say to someone, what was your childhood? I was at the Drake Hotel with him. We were on the, you know, one of the top floors and it was 56th and Park or something in New York City. And the sirens are going by and fire engines, you know, and you'd hear it waft up into the room. So I said to De Niro, the sound of New York is very different than the sound of L.A. or almost anywhere else. What was it like growing up in the city? And he almost walked out on me on that question. He got up, I can't answer a question like that. What was I asking him? I wasn't asking him to tell me about his sexuality of his father or something. I wasn't going that way. I was just saying to tell me what it was like growing up in the city. And this would happen over and over again. And it would be a real battle. And I would finally say to him, I said, Bobby, are you aware of what we're doing? Because what we're doing is what I'll be writing about. And you keep walking out. You leave after an hour all the time. Where are you going? He's always saying, I got to go. And he says, I'm meeting some friends. I said, your friends will wait. You're Robert De Niro. I said, you know, what we're doing is more important than just meeting your friends. You understand that? Or else, why are you here? And that was seven times. And I never got him more than an hour and a half. An hour and a half is whereas with John Huston, I'd spend the whole day. Or with Pacino, we'd spend 8.5 hours together, you know. It was different. But De Niro was and there was some anger there, you know. I would say that. So I guess I'm taking you to task a little bit with the word anger because I don't quite see the anger. I see the frustration, you know, and I see that there's a push and a pull to things, you know, which makes a good interview. And don't forget, I'm editing a lot. I may talk to someone for Streisand took 8 months or 9 months to talk to her. That's crazy, you know. But I had made an agreement with her that we will not finish this interview until we both say we're finished. If I said that to anybody else, I would have been out of there in less than an hour. They say, thank you very much, out you go. With Barbara, everything was on an equal plane. So if she had to get tiles for her swimming pool, or she had to make the album Superman, and you know, or she's working on A Star Is Born, and she's got to deal with all the sound of that, or talk to me in a Playboy interview, it was all equal. It was all the same. And I don't know how you can live like that because, you know, you got to have a balance in your life. You can't get so upset about the tiles as you would with the movie. You know, there's things you weigh.
We're going to take a break. I'm going to go lay some tile in my bathroom. It's the treatment. My guest is Larry Gobel. His new book is I Want You in My Movie, The Story of Working with Al Pacino. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW Music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm being chided by my guest, Larry Gobel, among the best interviewers in the world. First of all, Larry, how can people get your books?
Well, the first 12 books I did, the ones with Brando and the Houstons and stuff, that's available in bookstores if you can get to them, or you know, it's available on Amazon. And the last 12 books I've done have all been self-published.
Which includes I Want You in My Movie.
I Want You in My Movie is one of them. I had a publisher for it. I decided to self-publish it.
Because?
Same thing with the Capote book. I had a
Conversation with Capote.
Yes. And that has been published in a lot of languages.
And it had been published before.
Oh, yeah.
Because I have a hardcover of it.
It was originally published by New American Library, and then it came out in paperback, and then it's never been out of print. It's a wonderful book, thankfully, you know, for that. And it was my first book. But it took me 5 years to get the rights back from the last publisher, and I got it back. And then another publisher wanted to put it out and actually gave me a contract. I was about to do it. And then I said, no, why should I do it? I'm self-publishing my other books. And I would rather own my own books. You know, why give them the bigger percentage? What did they do? You know, I mean, I know that the book is a good book. It's been out for all these years. Let me keep it. So I did. Now I'm trying to write the books I want to write. So I'm writing novels. And I'm writing this memoir. And I know Streisand, there's a whole chapter about it in Streisand that I was a little concerned about writing because in it, I use what I wrote in my journal all those years ago. I've got 10,000 pages of a journal that I started when I started interviewing Streisand. That's when I realized it's important to keep a journal. But I had all this material with Streisand. We were battling all the time. She was calling me at 2 in the morning and apologizing for John Peters calling me at 1 in the morning and wanting to buy back the interview. And it was just crazy stuff, really crazy stuff. And I got it all down. And it's part of the chapter, you know, when I wrote my memoir thing. But it's my story growing up. How do I tell the stories I've done with all these famous people? This is what happened with Truman Capote, you know, when he wrote Answered Prayers. He lost all the people he knew. And it was a difficult thing, and I think it hurt him as a writer. He never finished that book. And I had the same problem. How do I deal with my relationship with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell, who would come to my house for dinner and I'd go to theirs? And then we had a falling out. Why did we have this falling out? It was very interesting. It was like a Guy de Maupassant story. It was ironic. It was a mistake. But I got so many of these stories. My relationship with Pacino, my relationship with Brando, with Diane Keaton, with Dolly Parton. You know, there's a lot of people. I didn't want to be that person telling stories out of school, so to speak. You know, I don't want to be a gossip person. I want to be able to tell a good story about how things really are. The only way I could do it, Elvis, to me, was to make it my story, not their stories in that sense. So I had to start from the beginning. I had to talk about my life. And how did a kid from Brooklyn get to be sitting on Marlon Brando's island, get to be with Barbra Streisand, get to travel in Dolly Parton's bus, go hang out with Luciano Pavarotti all over the United States? How did that happen? So that to me became the first part of my memoir. And I wrote this thing. By the time I got to the Brando section, it's 1980. It's 400 or 500 pages manuscript long, right? And so I said, wow. I said, this is really part one. It ends with the birth of my daughter and being with Brando. That's where the story ends at this point. And then it picks up with Pacino saying, I only want to talk to the guy who did Brando. And now I can tell all these other stories.
I guess what I find so interesting about this stuff, too, is that you were talking about Capote and these things. There's so much connection because I just remember what Brando was saying about Capote and quoting Ken Tynan saying the original should make all in cold cash and that he could have been a different person had he wanted to be a different person. Mm-hmm. He seemed like he was a bit more understanding about Capote than Capote was about him.
Well, you know, Capote, what he did was he went to see Brando during the making of Sayonara for The New Yorker. And Brando knew that he was coming. So he threw all these papers all over the floor and made it look like he was really working. Brando told me this. Capote, when he went in, he just saw all the papers. He thinks, oh, he's working so hard. So it was that. So they start drinking. And neither of these guys really could drink that well.
Yeah, you, you know? As you mentioned in both these things, that they were both very like light drinkers.
Right, right. So, so
and they both loved to talk, too, interestingly.
And what Capote started telling him was, well, when I was, you know, 3 years old, my mother locked me in the closet in the hotel room and she went out and I was... And he tells all this stuff to Brando. And Brando says, yeah, you know, that happened to me too. My mother used to go out. She'd be drunk in a bar. I'd have to carry her on my shoulder. And he'd tell that story. Well, Capote goes home with all this material that he does not tape record. He always, you know, he said he had a mind like a tape recorder. Well, that's questionable, but it's amazing as well. He spends a year writing this article. A year later, this article comes out. It's called The Duke in His Domain, and it has nothing about Capote in it. It's all about Marlon. And Marlon reads it and felt he was duped because, you know, they exchanged stories, but only his got in. So he got really annoyed, and he didn't talk again to a reporter until he agreed to do the interview with me all these years later. And that was only because Russell Means was in jail. It was $50,000 bond to get him out, the Indian activist. And he asked Brando, I guess they didn't have the money or whatever, but he called Hugh Hefner and said, Hef, would you mind bailing out Russell Means? And Hefner was smart enough to say, okay, I'll do that, Marlon, but maybe you can do something in return for the magazine. And Marlon first said, okay, he'll write something. He never wrote it. So then he agreed to do an interview. And once he agreed to do the interview, that's how I got the assignment.
It's the treatment. I don't have to pay anybody. My guest is the great interviewer, Lawrence Gorbel. I've told you this before, but I'm serious. I'm here because of reading that work you did. And the thing that I've taken away from that work is that every instance, no matter to whom you're speaking, you do them the compliment of having taken their work seriously.
Right.
Which I find at some point they all are disarmed by.
Yeah.
Because they're so used to, even Brando, and Streisand talks about it too. They catch Dolly Parton is really sweet the way you catch her off guard.
Yeah.
But was it shocking to you? Because I find it kind of interesting when it happens here, when people kind of are taken off balance by an interviewer who knows the work.
No, it's not shocking. It's what I expect in a way. In other words, I'll go in, and I know when people have been interviewed by so many people already, their eyes are blurry. Oh, another interview. I know my job is in the first 2 minutes, is to lock eyes with somebody and let them know that I'm serious and that I know more about you than you probably remember, and I'm going to remind you of those things. That's what I'm trying to get across, and I love doing those interviews. And unfortunately today, you don't see that anymore because even in Playboy, my interviews with 25 to 30,000 words long. That's half a book, really, of a short book. Nowadays in Playboy, they're about 4,000 words, maybe 5, and maybe even less. So you can't get all those nuances. You can't play all the things you could play with. You know, it's like having an orchestra with you. I can do things in a long interview. When I go into Al Pacino's kitchen, I see a box of cookies on top of the refrigerator. This was years ago in 79. I take down to get a cookie. The only thing is, there's about 30 cookies in there, and everyone had a bite in them. I couldn't believe that. So I didn't take any. I put it back up. Now we're talking, and in a lull of our talk, I said, can I just ask you an off-the-wall question? And he says, what is it? I said, how come you have half, all your cookies are half-eaten on your fridge? And he says, that's not true. I said, no, Al, it is. He says, that's absolutely not true. And then we're betting $5,000 over some kind of cockamamie thing like this, and I go and show it to him, you know? I mean, and that you can put in the interview if you have 25,000 words, but you can't put it in there because you got to talk about their movies, their career, you know? And what makes a really good interview is when you get those offbeat moments. To me, that's what makes the thing sparkle in there.
There are a number of these interview occasions where you're talking to people not because they've got something new coming out, but just because they were people who were worthy of the conversation, which also, it's got to be great for you because it relieves a burden of having to that moment where they go into that kind of autocorrect where they're
That. But the only time I was ever given like an instruction doing interviews was when I was doing the Playboy cable TV interviews. I had to always ask a sex question. It had to be the whole thing in there. So here I am talking to Neil Simon or something. It was okay when I did Marilyn Chambers Behind the Green Door and all that. That was all sex questions. Neil Simon says, I can't believe I'm sitting up here talking about my sex life, you know? And it's like, you know, it was funny to, you know, have to do that once in a while. But those are some of the restrictions. But I used to talk to them I talked to Miles Davis for 3 hours for an 8-minute interview. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty great. And how did he respond to the sex question?
I asked him what he saw in a woman, you know? what was the first thing? And the first thing he said was, her body. And then he looked at me and said, no, I'm kidding. He says, her carriage, the way she walks. That's the first thing he looks for in a woman. He says, and then her mind, you know, then her, see how she talks. I love Miles, man. My big mistake, I think, as a writer, and I turned down Ava Gardner at the end doing a memoir, and I turned down interviewing Stephen King and Clint Eastwood for Playboy. So I've done things that, you know, just for reasons that I felt were correct at the time. But I got along with Miles, and I wanted to interview him for again, but they weren't interested. But I thought—
What year would that have been?
I did Miles around 1985 or so. And I'm just so sorry that I didn't say, Miles, why don't we work on a book together? My thing is, I did this book on the use, and it's very hard to duplicate, and I did that over 25 years ago, and I never met another family like it. That's an incredible family, the Houston family, John and Walter and Angelica, the whole thing.
It's also an incredible book, and also the power dynamics in that house, and that's the sense, too, we get when John is in the room, he's so aware of the way he's addressing people, the way people are reacting to him.
He was an incredible man. He was incredible to be around, Elvis. I mean, I loved when you're going to talk to somebody for over 100 hours and then you're going to still be interested in what they have to say. And sometimes I would find out a story that was exaggerated. Montgomery Clift in The Misfits, there's a scene where he's in the telephone booth talking to his mother and he's sinking out or whatever. Well, that scene, I talked to the publicist, I talked to a general manager, I talked to Arthur Miller, I talked to two other people, and I talked to John Huston about it. And everyone told me a different story about that scene. Some said that was John's cruelest moment. He says, they said, I'll never forget seeing his finger whiplashing at Cliff, telling him, you've got to do it this way, you've got to do it. And Cliff was sinking into the ground. He was so intimidated by John. That's a powerful story. I said to Arthur Miller, that must have been something when John got so angry at Montgomery Clift that he did this. And Miller says, I don't remember that happening. And I was there, he says. I said, really? Now someone else tells me, yeah, John castigated, but he didn't sink all the way. Everybody told me a different story. How do you write that? How do you write that story when you can't corroborate it? So I wrote it as Rashomon. I have everybody telling a different story.
Which is also kind of like the tenor of the book because Houston basically had so many different versions of everything anyway.
Yeah. And he used to say to me, I once came back to him about these things and I said, John, I said, did this happen or this happen? He says, go with the better story, Larry. Always go with the better story. The best advice you can have.
But what's so great about that book, too, is seeing the difference between him and his daughter and just seeing how what that did to her.
Yeah. I mean, she grew up marrying her father a couple of times. You know, I mean, she was involved with Jack Nicholson and she's involved with Robert Graham. But she had a very, very tough life in a way, even though he was able to afford to go to St. Clarence and live in Ireland. What was it like for Tony and for Angelica growing up there? They didn't have that many friends. And it was strange to be so taken away by that. And then the way he treated the mother lived in the little house. He lived in the big house. Mistresses came. I mean, John was quite a man. He was quite a character. He killed a woman. He ran over a woman. And he had to flee the country. And his father had to help him get out. And he gets to England and he starts rolling homeless gay guys in Hyde Park to get their money. And then he gets back and then the next thing you know, he's directing the Maltese Falcon. It's an amazing story.
So is your work, Larry. It's a pleasure to have you here. Please. It's a thrill. Thank you so much for doing this.
Listen, if I can say one thing, I've admired your work just as much. And I say this seriously. And when I see you ever doing interviews, I said, Elvis is good. Elvis is good at it. And you are good at it. Look at you. You talk to me with no notes. That's good. That's good, Elvis.
If I could blush, I would. My guest is Lawrence Gorbel. Go to lawrencegorbel.com. And his new book is I Want You in My Movie, his work with Al Pacino. So the books are available on your website.
Right. They're available at lawrencegorbel.com. You can actually go to amazon.com, get any of these books. I'm doing a thing at Book Soup. Oh, January 25th. And so at 4:00, I'm going to be doing that and signing books.
On January 25th.
And I'm going to read for maybe a little section on that I wrote about Harlan Ellison. We could really talk about a lot of stuff else.
You'll have to come back. But I want to make sure we get the date. The date is January 25th. Right?
January 25th, at Book Soup in West Hollywood.
Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm not so good. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.